I would never in my life share this story were I not forced to do so. I've never told anyone. Only two living people know the truth, but I've been forced into a corner and I need advice. If you'd like to try turning me into the police for the events recounted in this post, then feel free, but know that this account is carefully maintained as to be untraceable to my true identity. You may think it's impossible. Nothing on the internet is anonymous, but I assure you, it is not only possible, but easy. If you know who to ask. If, however, you have a sound moral compass and can acknowledge that law does not always equal righteousness, please give me advice. Anything at this point is welcome. I still remember that night like it was just past, although it happened years ago. I was tortured by nightmares on a regular basis, at least 5 times a week throughout the past month. My son, who had heard me screaming at night from his room down the hall, kept asking what was wrong. I didn't know how to tell him. Now, however, I worry that the metaphorical bullseye that was on my chest is on his. I'm getting ahead of myself. I told you I was having nightmares about the event that other night. And I was. So many times a week, I believe I can recount them to you in relatively sound detail. It went something like this. My truck chases its headlights down the highway as I watch the car in front of me. I barely blink, intent on keeping track of the Honda. Nothing matters except the car in front of me, my target. Within my car and it, there are only two types of people, victim and survivor. It's yet to be determined who fits into what category. The car switches lanes, so do I, but a moment later. I can't lose this car, but I also can't let on that I'm following it. The man driving in front of me has a good reason to be wary. I've been watching for quite a while, learning the ins and outs of his travels, and by now I suspect his wind is up. I have no good reason to believe so, but I've relied on my intuition for much of my life. As soon as I realized doing otherwise was nonsensical and often dangerous, I made it a regular practice. And my gut's telling me he's spooked, like a hunted animal. With any luck, he'll disregard that little voice warning him that something is off. I have a feeling he's too comfortable, too arrogant to listen to it, but I can't bank on it. So extra care is key. The car exits the highway and turns onto a narrow dirt road. I stop at the gas station just before the turnoff. Now I know where he's headed, so there's no need to follow closely and give myself away. Let him have time to get settled in and cozy. Let his guard go down. I go inside to buy a cup of coffee, black as murder. And the clerk looks at me like I'm insane. Buying coffee at 11 at night. I just hand him my cash, make my way back outside without waiting for my change. My watch says it's 11:05. When did the Honda turn? About 5 minutes ago? Are the driver and his traveling companion in the cabin in the woods yet? Probably. Will they be prepared for my appearance? Only time will tell. But I don't think so. At 11:08, I get back in my truck and start the engine. I pull out of the stop and go, then flick my blinker on and turn down the same path the Accord took. The darkness of trees engulfs me, as if shielding the world outside of the woods from the carnage about to take place. I park about a half a mile from the cabin to avoid detection. I lift up the tarp in the back of my truck and peruse the tools there. I run my hands over a saw. No. Sawing his throat open seems a bit too much trouble, too messy. A drill, maybe. No, somehow that's not right either. I heft each weapon, test its weight in my hand and how it feels in my grip until I reach a pair of hedge clippers. The feeling in my gut warms up. This is it. After I stick a handgun and a can of starter fluid in my pocket for insurance, and slide the set of hedge clippers into my waistband, I jog to the cabin. Breathing the sharp, freezing air and feeling my heart do the jitterbug in my chest. All right. So the coffee was a mistake. At least now I know better, although it does me little good in my current situation. I walk to the back of the cabin and find the wires attaching a place to various amenities. I cut the phone line with the clippers. Now I'm effectively alone. I walk back around to the front of the cabin, hands shaking, and peer through the window at the scene inside. A feeble fire flickers in the grate, about to go out. A portly man crouches in front of it, trying to build it with matches and twigs. A boy sits in the armchair in the corner of the room, watching the man stoke the fire. He's an absolutely beautiful boy, beautiful enough to take my breath away. A head of hair as fiery red as a phoenix feathers, tussling and untidy, fair skin unmarred by scars of acne, but doused with a spray of freckles across the bridge of the nose, wide amber eyes, shining in the meek light of the excuse of a fire on the other side of the room. And now seeing the boy, all I can think about is seeing his beauty up close. My heart swells in my chest. My blood runs hot. This is why I'm here. This boy. And I'll kill anyone who stands in my way. The man at the fire, Jamie, is his name, turns and smiles. He speaks, and although his voice is muffled through the glass, I can still hear what he's saying. Why don't you go upstairs, Robin? There's a heater in the bedroom. And close the door. I don't want the warmth getting out. Can't have you catching a cold. The boy rises and drags his feet up the stairs, his face as long as Tolstoy's War and Peace as he disappears into the second floor. I step towards the door and knock. Rap, rap. As I hear the man rise with a grunt and a creak of floorboards, I stick my hand in my pocket and wrap my fingers around the pistol. I doubt I'll need it, but still, just in case. Steps towards the door. Clump, clump, clump. Sound of a door too comfortable and its frame shifting as he turns the doorknob, a pair of wide eyes staring at me as I analyze his face, and then I smile. He tries to shut me out, but I stick my foot between the door and the door frame. Hello, Jamie. Do you know who I am? Then it becomes clear that he can't overpower me. The idiot actually backs up, allowing me to open the door and step into the warmth of the cabin. Of course I know who you are. I'm calling the police. He runs to the phone and puts the receiver to his ear, and I laugh. Go ahead, try it. See what good it does you. Puts the phone down. He's heard the silence that signifies a deadline. You're not supposed to be here. You don't have custody of Robin. Lisa and I do.
Yeah. Well. I'm here anyway.
Tell Lisa to stick the courts on me. That is, if you live, which is unlikely. I don't care. I step towards him. He backs away again, but he's almost against the wall. There's no escape. A rush of hatred hits me for this little rat of a man, as thick and consuming as a mudslide. I let go of the handgun in my pocket and instead reach for the hedge clippers that I tucked into my waistband, relishing the surety of the handle's rubber grip against my palm. A handgun's too quick for the likes of him. I won't let him. I want him to suffer. And we have all the time in the world. No one's coming to his rescue, and he certainly isn't leaving. I snip the clippers in my hand and smile as Jamie begins to scream, "Schnick, schnick," a lovely sound. Don't. I swear I'll... You what? He doesn't answer, and I position the clippers against his large stomach. You what? Ralph, please. You brought this on yourself, you sick bastard. Schnick. Stick, like cutting paper, except for the blood. Once he's on the floor, I turn him over to hide his destroyed abdomen, toss the clippers on top of his body, and look up the staircase. The boy, Robin, is peering down to the first floor from around the corner. I strip off my bloodstained jacket, my favorite hoodie. What a shame. Come here. Staring at me with wide eyes, he creeps down the stairs like a scared animal. I wipe my hands on my ruined sweatshirt, then cup his cheeks. It's all right. It's all right. It's over. His golden eyes, so much like his mother's, filled with tears. Is it? I smile. Yeah. Robin, it's over. I promise. But don't. He hiccups and stops speaking. Seemingly at a loss for words. Don't what? Don't believe it? He nods, his cheeks wet. Look. I turn him towards the body lying several feet to his right. He's gone. And we're about to burn this place down with him inside so nobody has to know about a thing. Go outside, wait a few feet away from the house. I'll be there in a minute. He exits the house. Wiping his tears with the heels of his hand, I put the can of starter fluid from my pocket and I spread it the contents around the room, especially over Jamie. Then I make a trail right to the fire. I'm barely out of the house before the flames whoosh into life, bringing the light and warmth into a cold, dark night. We walk to the truck. Robin's so tired he's stumbling, and he needs me to guide him with a hand on his back. When we reach the vehicle,
climbs in like a warm, torn soldier, slumping onto his seat and closing his eyes. As I start the engine, he asks,
Dad?
Yes?
How did you know?
Know what?
How did you know that he... that...
He can't bring himself to say that he's been molested on multiple occasions in that cabin. But that's okay. I already know. That gut feeling. In me, it's so strong it's almost more of a supernatural power, a true sixth sense. Than that typical intuition. Once I leaned in to listen to it, I could never be fooled again, and that included every time I saw my son and he told me that he was fine when he wasn't. I pulled him to me and I hugged him close, winked tears away. Don't worry about it, honey. Just close your eyes. Just go to sleep. 5 minutes after... 5 minutes after we start driving, he's snoring. Thus, the first portions of my nightmare went. They were, in case you were wondering, about events that took place. My ex-wife, the Lisa mentioned above, is a part of my dreams, married a pedophile who molested my son on multiple occasions, and after I found out, I killed him. Before anyone asks, no, I didn't go to the law because I've been in considerable legal trouble in the past, and I know the police wouldn't have done a damn thing to stop him. Killing him seemed the safest route, and so far it's proven to be. His disappearance was chalked up to a running off with a younger woman. Lisa always assumed Robin had gone with Jamie and had never brought his disappearance to the authorities. She never wanted the child anyway. Robin had been in an accident, and she had never cared for him, only taking custody of him to spite me, and Robin and I have lived quiet lives together in a small town. Quiet at least until my nightmares began a month ago. I've recounted the first portion of my dreams to you, and while some of you, maybe even the majority of you, may believe the reliving of those events is enough to terrify me, it isn't. I'm not sorry for what I did to Jamie, because he had it coming. It was the second part of those nightmares that froze my heart in my chest. I wake up from the dream of Jamie's death, thanking God that my son is safe and sound. However, the smile dies on my lips before it has the opportunity to blossom. Something's wrong. The smell of blood and smoke pervades the room. I sit up in bed, my heart beating. It's pulsing in my throat. God forbid there's a fire in the house. I swing my legs out of bed to go check on the house for a fire, and a charred hand latches onto my ankle. It's blistering hot, but it's not why I scream. I scream because the thing pulling itself out from under my bed behind the hand, its leering empty grin, its smoking skin, even in its destroyed state, I know that face.
Oh, Ralph. You know who I am.
God, I do. I do.
I yank my ankle from its grip and run, but he grabs it again and I trip and I fall on my friends and he towers over me, so weak in life yet strong after death, his burning hands descending onto my throat.
At that point, I always wake up, sweating and in shambles. The first time I had the nightmare, I assumed it was a random flare-up of guilt years late. I thought maybe I had repressed the emotions and was only feeling it now because I couldn't help but gush out. I walked out into the kitchen and intended to pour myself a glass of bourbon to calm my nerves and I caught sight of a pair of bloody hedge clippers on the countertop. My blood frozen, I walk over and I pick them up. They were warm, and the handles had singe marks on them. I was concerned then that it was more than just repressed guilt causing me nightmares. I threw them out before Ralph stumbled upon them, but their message stayed with me. Furthermore, that message was reinforced throughout the months that I had nightmares by way of other signs, the smell of smoke, thick and noxious, at random points in the house, a constant feeling of being watched wherever I went, but especially when I was with Robin. As if something was jealous. I did my best to shrug it off, but at night, after Robin was in bed, I always feared sleep. For a month, I endured those nightmares without a clue of what they meant, except that they meant nothing good. They could have meant my death at the hands of Jamie's angry spirit. They could have meant my prevention of the sleeping soundly for the rest of my life. They could have been an omen of my secret getting out. Whatever the case, I had no idea what to do and didn't plan on taking action. My last nightmare, which happened 3 days ago, was different from the others, and it persuaded me to do otherwise. All followed the script that had been established. The remembrance of the incident in question, the fake awakening, Jamie's hand clamping down on my ankle. This time, however, rather than closing the grip around my throat, Jamie just hovered over me, smiling, smirking. I could feel the heat from his body baking me, drying out my eyes, and finally he said,
"I want that boy. I want that boy. And I'll have him."
Jamie's been very tired lately. I wake up sometimes at night to him screaming. When I ask him what's wrong, he just says he's not sleeping well. Having nightmares. When I ask him what about, he won't answer, but that intuition of mine. That intuition of mine knows what he's not telling me. My own safety becoming questionable wasn't enough to spur me to action. Robin's safety coming into question, however. I've killed to keep that boy safe once, and I'll do whatever it takes to keep him safe again. Any suggestions on how to defeat a vengeful spirit would be greatly appreciated.
Hey there, kids, it's me, Mr. Creepypasta, and I wanted to tell you all thank you so much for listening to tonight's story, or watching tonight's story if you're on YouTube. If you're not on YouTube, that means you're probably on the podcast that's available on iTunes, on the Google Play Store, and is now actually available on Spotify, and doesn't use as much data. So, hey, that's a thing. If you guys aren't listening on YouTube or Spotify, then I have no idea how else you could have found me. Unless you found one of those books on Amazon. You know, the Creepypasta Collection, Volume 1, Volume 2. Those are things, too. Oh, well. I don't know how you would have heard me there, seeing as this was recorded, like, 2 years after those came out. Well, anyway. Thanks for listening, folks.
And sweet dreams.